We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Drzezinski, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're back once again with John Andrasik. He has his Can One Man Save the World video featuring the Ukrainian orchestra and song. They are circulating on the internet. They're online. They're raising money for Save Our Allies. He's also finishing up his tour with Five for Fighting this week, so you can go to fiveforfighting.com to find the remaining dates. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Emily, nice to see you again.
We were just talking before the recording started to roll about how you have been on tour, and this is sort of a change of pace from the rock and roll lifestyle, talking a little bit about politics, if that's an escape from chaos. I don't know, John. It seems like it's chaos in both sort of spheres of your professional life right now.
You know, it almost seems like the shows are the off days because they're a little less stressful. Though they've certainly merged at every show we play the new song with the audio from the Ukrainian orchestra. And I talk about my trip to Ukraine and I talk about how it really started in Afghanistan, meeting some of these groups. So it's not really politics, but it is certainly a big part of my shows now. A lot of Afghan vets are coming. We play Blood on My Hands. The music is our opening. So it's been interesting how these new songs have merged with the old ones, but it's been a great tour and people are really kind of, you know, embracing some of the messages, and I'm very grateful. You know, haven't done a rock and roll tour back in the bus in 10 years, Emily. So, you know, I'm a little creaky, got a few injuries. We could probably bring a therapist with us on the road or, you know, pharmacy, but these old men, we're going to make it. I see the finish line.
Oh, man. Well, you know, it's starting in Afghanistan is really interesting because that was, I think around the time, it was the first time that you and I had the opportunity to talk, and it's about a year ago. We're almost exactly a year removed from the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Biden administration's withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan, which was an utter disaster. It was a national embarrassment. And John, with a year sort of in the rearview mirror now and the journey sort of having begun, even for you personally, over the course of the last year, are there some big standout lessons or even some big remaining problems you think folks should know about?
Of course. I'm still, just 2 days ago, I got another Save Me email from people still stranded, SIV holders. And, you know, as much of a disgrace that our withdrawal was, abandoning our citizens, abandoning our allies, abandoning $80 billion, breaking our promise, I think the aftermath is even worse because you can make a case that, look, our intelligence failed, we made mistakes, it was chaotic, which it was. But in the aftermath, these rescues that have been going on by these private organizations, they're being hindered by the State Department. And that is a conscious act. The fact that the State Department is, you know, throwing up roadblocks to the Americans who are keeping the promise to our citizens and allies, to me, that's even a bigger disgrace than the withdrawal. And the fact that it'll take 5, 6, 10 years to evacuate all the P1, the P2, the SIV holders we promised to evacuate their families, that's intentional. And again, the moral shame of Afghanistan will not go away. And look, we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary. I'll certainly have some reminders coming up with a new video and a new message. And time will not erase this open wound. On the positive side, I do know after the midterms, there's many in Congress who want to hold hearings because there's been zero accountability. Not one person has resigned. Not one person has been fired from their extraordinary success. So I do think I had a show just 2 nights ago in Atlanta when this Afghan veteran came up to me afterwards, this big guy in tears. You would think it was 9 months ago. Same things. You know, thank you for keeping Afghanistan in front. Thank you for talking about our allies. As long as you talk about it, they're still alive. But every day somebody's being hunted, and it's not just our allies. I mean, look, girls after sixth grade can still not go to school. Forced marriages, 14-year-olds being married, women's rights decimation, lesbians and gays being hunted. So again, I think we've swept it under the rug, and you'll probably see a few things on the anniversary. But unfortunately, America's turned the page, and certainly Afghanistan has not. And we talked, you know, months ago about how Ukraine was probably next, and now we're in Ukraine, and frankly, Taiwan's probably next. So the dominoes keep falling, and it really started with Afghanistan.
Can you tell me more about your experience with the State Department and the experience of people that you talked to with the Biden State Department actually hindering rescue efforts? What's happening sort of behind closed doors that we have, you know, maybe some insight to? And why on earth? I think a lot of listeners might ask themselves those questions. Why on earth would the Biden administration hinder rescue efforts when people are voluntarily sending information their way?
I asked the exact same question. And this is not just me talking. After withdrawal, I embedded with many of these groups, Project Exodus Relief, Task Force Pineapple, Save Our Allies. And I literally sat on the Zoom calls and I asked the same question, like, why would they do that? I think part of it is political. They just want the whole thing to go away. Part of it has a rational reason of vetting, want to make sure people are vetted. You want to say there are the people that we should be getting out. But there's really no good reason. I think they're embarrassed. And every time you hear one of these orgs rescuing people, it just points to their disgrace. I think they just want to cover it up and the whole thing go away. I've been told that certain countries that have been open to taking more refugees, that the State Department has quashed that. But look, we just spent, what, $2 trillion on Build Back Better, and we spent now just spent, what, $700 billion in the latest bill. The amount of people processing SIV holders, I'm told it's like you can fit them in a room. It's a disgrace. What they should have done is hired 1,000 people to start processing these SIV holders. And frankly, the most important people were the special forces Afghans that we trained that are now facing a choice of being killed or joining the Taliban. So there's 20,000 special forces. So this is not just a moral issue. It's a national security issue. 20,000 Afghans we trained, special forces, highly trained, that will either flip and we'll be fighting them in the years to come or be killed. So there's so many aspects of this. We could talk for hours. But you know, it is the great shame, and this is not coming from me. This is coming from multiple organizations who call me crying, saying I can't believe the State Department is hindering these efforts. And as I said, after the midterms, there will be hearings, and General Milley, General Austin, Secretary Blinken, and everybody that has been kind of fronting this effort will have to answer the questions you just asked. And I look forward to that day, and hopefully I'll be sitting in the back of that room.
Well, the groups you work with on this are not political. It's not as though the Biden administration is stonewalling a bunch of Republican or conservative advocacy groups. These are military groups. And John, could you explain, also since you mentioned the SIV visas, could you just tell us what those are and what kinds of people are eligible for them and are sort of in processing limbo right now?
Yeah, so if you've been an interpreter, translator, if you've worked for the Americans in Afghanistan, we basically have a special immigrant visa, which basically a promise that says you can come to the United States. Basically, we have your back. You helped us. We're going to protect you if things go bad. And at the outset of the war, I was told there was about 70,000, but I mean, not the war. I'm sorry, the withdrawal, 70,000. But of course, those folks have family members. So there's 240, quarter million, probably more. And you hear many stories of literally families that were at planes, ready to get on a plane. And you had State Department officials saying, well, you can take three. You have a family of eight. So people literally had to pick what family members that they would take to save and what would have to, those who have to be left to the Taliban. So it's just insane. It boggles your mind. But these are promises we've made that we have not kept. And then forget about all the Afghan troops that served with us, that we trained. Certainly in my mind, if you're willing to die and save the life of our soldiers, which many of them did, we probably have an obligation to not leave you to terrorists. So I, you know, to me, that's a de facto. And then there's P1s, P2s, different levels of promises. And then, of course, you know, all the people that are at risk that we've talked about. So the sad fact is very few are going to get out. And, you know, 20 million women now are subject to this, 14th century, you know, Game of Thrones gulag. And it, again, it just breaks your heart. And but you know what? They're still trying. They're still on these calls. There's still people in Pakistan. Now we're trying to get the people that we've evacuated out of Afghanistan to find homes, because a lot of them, a lot of the countries they're in will not take them. And frankly, some folks on the Republican side are holding up this Afghan Evac Act because they're very nervous about the immigration issue. I'm like, I understand the border. It's a good argument. But if these are SIV interpreters that worked for America, you need to like get over your little political tantrum and help them come to America.
How odd was it to hear the news that a longtime, incredibly important Al-Qaeda strategist like Zawahiri was killed by a drone, an American drone, on a balcony in Kabul about a year after the withdrawal, after the president of the United States said, we did what we needed to do. We had basically stamped Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan. And yet a year later, you have a huge operative just on a balcony in Kabul.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's great that we got him. OK, you know, we've been waiting for a long time. It's great we got him. But of course, virtually everything that's coming out of this administration regarding Afghanistan has been political. The withdrawal was political. They wanted their little, carrot for getting out on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. The fact that we, you know, abandoned Bagram, you know, go down the list. And why would that change? Secretary Blinken said, anybody who can get out can get out. And nobody in Europe is angry with us. Everything they said has been, frankly, the opposite of the truth. So we all knew that Al-Qaeda would reconstitute in Afghanistan. Anybody who follows this is not surprised. Has there now become a full collaboration with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? Of course. Yeah, I think we'd be shocked if it didn't happen. You know, I'm glad they got, you know, they got Zawahiri, but again, it just shows you that this is not just a one moment disaster and some bad things happened, that the ramifications are frankly going to be generational, not just for Afghanistan, but, you know, for our reputation.
Yeah, it makes me think of how Al-Qaeda sort of grew out of the Mujahideen and the American sort of fighting in that territory years and years ago, coming back. And we have just now gotten out of this 20-year quagmire in Afghanistan, and there's a huge vacuum after a very sudden withdrawal, and that's going to create forces that are certainly darker than when we were in the country. And if we had executed some sort of competent withdrawal that you'd think, with all of the money that we send to the Pentagon every single year, we would be perfectly capable of. Not to say it's easy, but it's certainly, there was a way to do it better if that was the plan. It seems as though, and I'm curious your perspective on this as someone who's still in contact with folks in Afghanistan and people who have recently been able to flee Afghanistan, that things are getting very dark very quickly in ways that could absolutely affect the United States.
Look, anybody I talk to on Congress or military experts that can have been there and know the terrain and know the landscape and the culture, they say it's only a matter of time before we have to go back in. Will it be a terrorist attack? Will it, you know, will it be something like a 9/11? Likely. And look, I still think the argument of why didn't we just leave 2,000 soldiers in Bagram? Because that's why the Afghan army collapsed. They had no support. You know, their backbone basically deserted them. So they really had no support. I mean, we have scattered troops in countries around the world. 1,000 here, 2,000 here, 5,000 here, 20,000 there. We'd had maybe one casualty or two casualties in the last few years. So it wasn't like American soldiers were dying every day there. I don't understand why we didn't just keep Bagram, leave a few thousand troops, keep the support of the Afghan army so they don't collapse. Is it perfect? No. But is it better than this? I think so. And I think time will prove that out. But yeah, we just saw, you know, probably the first round of that with Al Qaeda's, you know, presence. And sadly, I think it's just more to come. And that's what I'm told by the folks who do this for a living.
Now, you have made a recent trip to Ukraine, and you've been advocating on behalf of the Ukrainian people amidst the invasion. Can you tell us about your trip? Frankly, what did you see when you were over there?
It was surreal. It actually started with Save Our Allies, the group that I was working with in Afghanistan, when I'd written this song, Can One Man Save the World, kind of about the Ukrainian people, Zelensky, turning down our plane ticket and saying, send me some stingers. But the song was really about us, about, you know, who are we? You know, America has a tradition of supporting freedom, especially when it's geopolitical rivals like Russia and China. And I'd gone on tour with my string quartet, and I was arranging strings for the song because I wanted to play it on my tour. And I had a thought of, hey, maybe I should go to Poland and play the song with the Polish orchestra, because I'd seen them doing some performances. Certainly Poland has been a hero in this war, taking millions of refugees. Their president was one of the first people to go to Kyiv after the war started. So I reached out to my Save Our Allies pals, and I said, I know you have relationships in Poland, and how about this idea? They said, let me call you back. She called me back a few days later and said something I'll never forget. She said, how would you like to go to Ukraine and play this with the Ukrainian orchestra? And that was my sense, that kind of, was my feeling as well. And my first question was, do they even exist? I mean, it's a war. And she said, well, they're scattered across the country, but the ministry would like this to happen. We could find a 2-day window, bring them to Kyiv, record the song, and go film a video. So I didn't know what was going to happen until weeks later. I was on tour for my last show, and I got an email with a plane ticket to Krakow in my inbox, and had a long talk with my wife that night, as you might imagine. And the next day I was on a plane to Amsterdam, to Krakow. Crazy journey. I went with these special forces, kind of Save Our Allies heroes, Nick Palmaciano, and a crew of American filmmakers. And we jetted to the border in 3 hours, had to walk across the border, try to find a car to get to Lviv, chase the train, literally hopped on a train with Dan Crenshaw and Brian Fitzpatrick. Thank you, Brian and Dan, for letting us borrow your train for a 15-hour ride to Kyiv. And then we found ourselves filming this video in hollow ground on a war zone. You probably know, Emily, the symbol of Ukrainian independence is an airplane. It's called the Maria, biggest cargo plane in the world. Soviets flew their space shuttle on it, was active during COVID. And it's actually the symbol on their patch, on their army patch, is the plane. And when Putin first tried to take Kyiv, he went to the Antonov airport where the Maria is hangared and blew it up, destroyed it. And we were allowed to film the video in front of this destroyed Maria, literally in this battlefield of jet fuel and blown up tanks. There were still, frankly, human remains on the location. And we put the orchestra right in front of the Maria and put the piano there, and we filmed it. And I think it was perfectly symbolic of the fortitude of the Ukrainian people. You know, Putin tried to gut their will, and they're, no, here we are. Even though, you know, we play cellos and violins and this guy sits at a piano, you're not going to intimidate us. And it was a powerful, surreal, humbling experience. I understand there's a lot of complications with Ukraine. I understand about our aid, the question about that. I understand about, you know, some of the dark side of Ukraine. And all those, I think, are relevant and need to talk about. But when you go there and you see these people fighting for their freedom and their survival, It hits you right here. And I think for me, it was a powerful experience. And the song continues to grow. We're dealing with Ukrainians, Poland. We're trying to call for this big Live Aid type global concert for Ukraine. Artists of the world need to step up for this generation. So that's our big goal. If you haven't seen it, I think your audience, whatever their feelings on Ukraine, I think they'd appreciate our mission there. And all the proceeds do go to Save Our Allies. So we are raising money to continue their operations. Last point is, Save Our Allies, they were the organization that saved Benjamin Hall's life, the Fox News that was severely injured. I literally saw the ambulance he was in. I met the person who drove it. So they are doing incredible work. They just saved another American reporter who was severely injured. So whatever you're feeling on Ukraine, Zelensky is, these folks are amazing. What they did in Afghanistan, 12,000 people out in 10 days, now in Ukraine. They're certainly worthy of a share of the video because the proceeds will go to them.
You know, I was going to say, John, you know, folks may not, you and I might not agree on the specifics and the strategy when it comes to Afghanistan or Ukraine, but the political sphere has a tendency, and I know I'm guilty of this at times, to talk about this as though it's a game of risk, and it's pawns on a board, and it's a conversation about the strategic minutiae, or even the big picture, that what gets lost in it are the human faces and the human victims. And I'm really curious as to what you heard from the Ukrainian people when you were there. You've mentioned the word resilience, and it's one I've heard a couple of times. What was morale like, and what was Kyiv like when you were there? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about when you were there too, what time of year it was.
Yeah, it was towards the end of May.
Okay.
And certainly most of the fighting was in the east. And as we came from the west, you know, when we were in Lviv, you probably wouldn't know a war was going on, you know, in the west. The kids were out playing, people were in the shops, there were tourists there. But when we got to Kyiv, you could feel the weight. Half the businesses, you know, were still closed. Everywhere you looked, there was like, here's the sign to go to the bunker when the missiles start falling. You could feel in the people just the seriousness of the situation, what they'd been through. They were going about their daily lives because you kind of have to. You have to work. At the same time, there's no fuel. All the fuel is being used by the military. So that's one reason we had to take a train. My translator was a 21-year-old bartender. She frankly looks like you, Emily. I mean, she was this young woman who was a bartender a year ago and then joined the army, like so many of them have. And speaking to the orchestra through translators, virtually every one of them had either lost somebody in the war, had somebody on the front, had somebody was missing. But they would also say to me things like, with every atrocity Putin commits, it just makes us stronger and angrier. And so you felt that kind of Eastern European resistance. And they'd also tell me about, look, we understand tyranny. We lived, our grandparents know how to live under this oppression. You in America have forgotten about that. So we know what this is. And they have, I think, a sense and desire for freedom, probably like our ancestors did. So they're, I think they're half grateful for the United States for the aid, but I think they're also frustrated that why aren't you doing more? Because I do think the consensus in around and Poland too, I had longer conversations in Poland. I think the consensus is what everything about Zelensky or Ukraine, if Putin takes Ukraine, he's not stopping there. And I think the surrounding countries, Poland in particular, are very concerned. And my big concern is a selfish one. I don't want our soldiers dying in Eastern Europe in 2 or 3 years under a similar dynamic.
Right.
My big argument, I know a lot of your colleagues at the Federalist are kind of down on the support of Ukraine, and I understand the reasons. Many of them are friends of mine, and I think it's important to have these conversations. The $40 billion was a joke. To send that without oversights,
Yeah.
it reminds me of what we did in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Here's a check. All things are better. We say so. I literally sat there. I sat at the border. I saw 5 miles of trucks with drivers standing out them that have been there for days. And my first thought was, what's in those trucks and where's it going? And I had meetings. I sat with Fitzpatrick and talked about some of the supply lines. You know, Save Our Allies they are the last line. The stuff gets the key, but they help get, you know, the humanitarian aid out to the east. So all these questions that we're asking as Americans and that you and your colleagues are asking are legitimate. And we should have American eyeballs on the ground in Ukraine, seeing where this stuff is going. The fact that we don't really, again, shows you this administration is acting in a political manner, not one that's trying to help this war. And the Ukrainians feel, are you giving us just enough to lose? Because they shut down the MiGs. You know, we can give you MiGs. No, you can't. And every time, you know, you give them some of these long range kind of artillery, which they need. So they're torn between this. We're grateful, but you're America. Don't you really want Putin to take Ukraine? So there's and there's a lot of, frankly, it's interesting. There's a lot of kind of mixed feelings about Zelensky, even within Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his popularity had decreased a good bit before the war.
Yeah, I mean, he's like it'd be like an American politician. You know, we have our built-in feelings about our politician before the war starts. You know, so folks that were anti-Zelensky, I think they appreciate his leadership. They appreciate he didn't leave the country. They understand it's a big, big weight on this man. But they also have these kind of feelings of, yeah, he's not my guy. He's not my side. So it was fascinating to see the feelings within Ukraine about Zelensky. So, of course, you know, again, we could talk for hours, but to see it firsthand. And last thing, there was a moment that I think crystallized this for we Americans, our crew, when we were filming a take of the orchestra in front of the Maria. A general came by, and it was the general that turned out that approved our filming there. And he wanted to let me know that Zelensky personally approved it, thanked us for coming through a translator, of course.
Right.
And then he said something that was kind of wild. He said, "Let me hear the song." and you could see when the orchestra saw him, they all really perked up and they stood up and they were very moved because he is one of the leading generals in Ukraine. It'd be almost like, you know, MacArthur, you know, showing up at your video shoot, you know, and they started to play with vigor and energy and passion. And the general got emotional. He took out his phone. He started filming it. His whole entourage, all these Rambos, took out their phones. They put on their sunglasses because they started to start tearing up. And at the end of that performance, there was a silence and a weight that I think we all felt of this collaboration, this American with these Ukrainians singing this song about Ukrainian fortitude, in this country of these people fighting for their survival. And I think it really hit a lot of us and my Save Our Allies team and our film crew about why we were there. And we felt that kind of really validated our trip and our mission.
It reminds me of the question I was going to save for last, but I'll ask now because I think it's so relevant. In the early days of the war, there were a lot of folks on the left who seemed really to be admiring, and I mean this in a good way, the nationalism, the sense of national pride that Ukrainians were demonstrating. And at the same time, that was kind of frustrating because I think a lot of the same people have demoralized our country and have or have attacked the concept of nationalism and tried to undercut the sense of American patriotism and pride. And seeing what you saw in Ukraine, talking to so many American members of the American military over the course of the last year and before that as well, does it make I wanted to ask you about the morale of America's military, of people who have served as they come up to you. Is there any sense of, I mean, do they seem very demoralized in your experience, or is it different than that? I don't know. I'm just curious what you've heard.
That is a very insightful question. And it has been fascinating to see kind of the political bent of both my two songs, the Afghanistan song and the Ukraine song. Certainly with the Afghanistan song, the right embraced it, the left didn't. And I understood why. Frankly, if it was Trump and I would bring the same song, I'm sure the left would embrace it. And I think many on the right would have as well. But not all of them, you know, not all the right. Ukraine, initially the song was embraced by the wide swath of people. Certainly many on the left did. And I asked myself the same question about, well, you're you're really loving this guy who's basically risking his life and trying to save his people, talking about freedom and this nationalism. But in America, that seems that you're canceled for that.
Yeah.
You're ostracized for that. And then they want America to do these things. I'm like, well, that doesn't, doesn't that mean, you know, America is the kind of shining light on the hill?
Yep.
That we say it is. You want us to go help Ukraine and do the right thing and fight for freedom and go after Putin. And that means we are the good guys, right? But you spend your time talking that we're the bad guys. So I thought that was interesting. To your question about the military, Afghanistan's really gutted a lot of the military. And I have friends who are veterans who have children that are considering going into the military. And they have told me, for the first time in my life, I'm telling my kids, don't do it.
Right.
Don't go in. Which really breaks my heart.
I've heard that too. Longtime families where it's their tradition of serving. I've heard they're breaking the chain, basically.
Fourth, fifth generation military families with kids of enlistment age, and many of them are saying, don't do it. Look what we did. We abandoned our allies. We have no honor. We broke the code. We're calling this Afghanistan thing extraordinary success. You see what's happening in Ukraine. You see what's happening in Taiwan. I think they really feel we have an appeasement administration and an Orwellian one to some degree. And that scares them. Not so much for them, but for their kids who are going to fight these wars. And that's why I think so many agree with me on Ukraine, whatever you think of Zelensky. We've seen this movie before, right? There's a reason Churchill's in my video. The only person who's not Ukrainian and not a musician is Churchill. We've seen this before. We know appeasement doesn't work. There's Chinese planes flying over Taiwan as we speak. We talked about this months ago, the dominoes. So I think the sad thing is that our adversaries understand there's this window with this administration that if they're going to move, they're going to move soon. And if you're a father or a mother with a 18-year-old who's considering going to the military, what would you say?
Mm-hmm.
So I certainly understand their sentiment. It's similar to the police out there. You know, you see police retiring in droves. You see the military, many folks getting out. At the same time, last night, I played Can One Man Save the World, and the guy sent me an email saying, you know what, I'm going to re-enlist because I need to go do the right thing. So, you know, there are folks out there that